So I was originally scheduled to go earlier in the day, and I understand the organizers received a phone call from someone in the organization asking that I be moved later so that I would have the ability to present this without spilling the beans in advance of the press conference. So I'll talk about the observation of gravitational waves from a 22 solar mass, and I understand that this is how you hyphenate this. I don't know. Anyway, binary black hole coalescence. I recently moved to Tokyo, so if there are any Chinese or Japanese people in the audience who can read this, this is a bit of a joke. It turns out that I have a rare example of a name that can be written meaningfully in Japanese. This is Kanon, it's the symbol for Buddha, and this is the symbol for ticket. So Buddha ticket is my name in Japanese. Okay, so where you can find information about these latest results, the paper is available through the LIGO Document Control Center. It has the code, the date code of the event, so September, so 2015, December 26th. So it was seen on Boxing Day in UTC. In North America, it was late Christmas night. So this is what I spent Christmas evening doing, and then most of that night as well. There's a LIGO Open Science Center, LOSC, and if you go there, you can find the data for this event, as well as the audio files that you heard Gabby presenting during the press conference, and all sorts of sort of public outreachy sort of stuff, posters and so on. We have also made available all of this information for the earlier event, this LVT whatever signal, that people had decided to not disclose the contents of earlier. I think personally, I think that was a mistake. I think mathematically it was always favored to be a signal, and so now we've just decided to make everything available. Okay, so this is the punchline. We've got a title and an abstract, and what we see is a pair of black hole masses, this time an asymmetric system, so a 14 solar mass and a 7 solar mass black hole. They're lighter altogether than the previous signals, and asymmetric. Less energy is radiated during the merger, but it's approximately as far away as the first detection, GW150914. So it's at a Z of about 0.1. So these masses are the source frame masses for the event. So as the gravitational waves have traveled to Earth, they've been redshifted, and that dilation of the frequency is degenerate with mass. It just looks like an overall shift in the mass. So when the gravitational waves arrive at Earth, they look exactly like the gravitational waves from a system that's heavier. So this uncertainty here actually includes the uncertainty due to the redshift on the masses. Okay, so for those who haven't been following the history of gravitational wave astronomy, I thought I'd give a little bit of a history. As has been mentioned already, in 1915, Albert Einstein published a Lorentz invariant theory of gravity in which it's described as the dynamic curvature of space-time. Today we call this theory general relativity. At almost exactly the same time, and I can't remember whether it was in the same issue of the journal or the same volume, but almost immediately, Karl Schwarzschild, who had been in communication with Einstein, published the first solution of the field equations. Einstein had thought these equations would never be solved. They're nonlinear and extremely complicated. What Schwarzschild did is what we teach all undergrads to do. He set as many derivatives to zero as possible. He created a spherically symmetric solution, reducing the field equations down to a one-dimensional ODE for a radial function, which he was able to solve. And he did this while serving in the trenches on the Eastern Front during the First World War. So it was quite a remarkable feat. He didn't survive the war. He did not get shot. He died of a disease. But he did this possibly by candlelight in the trenches. It's quite a remarkable feat. About a year later, Albert Einstein published a wave solution. He took the weak field limit of general relativity and showed that you can get a wave equation out of it. So Schwarzschild's solution, no one really knew what it described. It had some odd properties. There's a singularity in it. The solution became invalid for some radial coordinates. And it took a long time to figure out what it was he had obtained a description of, and we now know what he had obtained a description of was a black hole. Similarly, Einstein's wave solution faced a great deal of debate. It wasn't known whether these waves were a real phenomenon or whether they too were some sort of artifact of a poor choice of coordinates in which he had done his work. And that took many decades to sort out. So by the 1950s, it had been decided for the most part that gravitational waves were in fact a real phenomenon and carried energy, and people began exploring the possibility of detecting them. Most notoriously, Joseph Weber pioneered the use of resonant bar antennas for gravitational wave detection. Now his efforts, he began to make claims of detections, which did not survive the scrutiny of peer review, and he developed a bit of a reputation for publishing false claims, and that has kind of colored the field of gravitational wave astronomy since. So that's partly why there's so much secrecy in our field for these detections. We want to ensure that our detections are published first in a peer-reviewed journal and not in the New York Times. So we hold them very close to ourselves until we are absolutely certain that they are correct. By the 60s and 70s, the first use of laser interferometers for gravitational wave detection efforts were being attempted. One of the most famous early efforts is the so-called Malibu interferometer, built by a group at Hughes Aircraft in Malibu. In 1992, the LIGO project was funded, and between 2001 and 2010, the LIGO project conducted 6 observing runs jointly with other interferometers that had been constructed around the world, the GEO-600 interferometer, a joint project of the UK and Germany, Virgo, a joint project of France and Italy, and the TAMA interferometer in Japan, as well as the resonant bar detectors that were still in operation during this period. other gravitational wave detection efforts are ongoing. There's pulsar timing efforts and efforts to look for evidence of gravitational waves in CMB polarizations. So in September of 2015, Advanced LIGO's first observing run started, and almost immediately, within tens of hours of the start, we made the first detection, and it took us until February to publish it, which is 2016, which is 1916 plus 100 years. So that was a nice round number. All right, so in early September, I'll just give a bit of a set the stage for today's announcement. So in early September 2015 was what we were calling the engineering run. The detectors were not yet taking science data. People were still in the process of going into the observatories and editing the control system software for the antennas and basically commissioning the system. So early Monday morning, September 14th, it was 9:50 UTC. So most of the Europeans were up in their offices. But in North America, it was 4:50 a.m. local time at Livingston and 2:50 a.m. local time at Hanford. So people were not yet in at the observatories. A low latency burst search called coherent wave burst, it registered a moderate significance candidate, whose time frequency spectrogram appeared to be the merger of a pair of black holes. So that candidate was uploaded to the database with a latency of about 3 minutes. Now, there were 2 low latency dedicated compact object searches running at the time. Neither of them found the candidate. And this initially caused some confusion. So firstly, the fact that we were still in an engineering run state, we were not taking science mode data, led to some confusion. It wasn't clear what state the interferometers were in. Had somebody been at home putting fake signals in to test it? What was going on with the observatories? Also, why had the compact object searches not seen it? Now, what hadn't been realized by most of the collaboration was that the compact objects group had chosen to restrict the scope of the low latency searches to just low mass systems, so ones involving at least 1 neutron star, in the belief that people with optical telescopes to whom we would send alerts would not be interested in black hole only candidates. So this all got sorted out, and by Wednesday at 1700 UTC, so this was 2 days of wondering, and it seemed like weeks at the time, but it was actually only 2 days, we finally decided to inform our electromagnetic observer counterparts of the event. The automatic alert system that should have done that automatically was not turned on yet because we were still in this engineering run. So an email was sent manually to the people, and that of course created confusion on their end. They didn't know what to make of this manual email. It didn't arrive the way the alerts were supposed to arrive. So it was determined that 16 days of coincident data would be required in order to establish the significance, the statistical significance of the event. So we sat back and waited for that data to be collected. And while we did, a second binary black hole merger candidate was identified. Now, its false alarm probability was very high. It's a few percent. So which means, so in approximately 50 equivalently prepared signal-free experiments, you would expect to see something like it just by accident. So on its own, it's not significant enough for a detection claim, but I'll mention more about this event later. It was also found on Monday morning. I think it was 4 weeks and 4 minutes following the first event. So there was first Monday and second Monday came to be their names. So this is what GW150914 looks like in whitened data. This plot is meant to explain how we identify the events and assess their significance. So what you have here in the gray, and this, people have shown this many times now, so I won't spend too much time on it, but this is a downsampled version of the detector's output. The data is collected at 16,000 samples per second. There's only 2,000 samples per second shown here. All the high frequency components have just been removed because you can see we're only interested in low frequency stuff here, so that high frequency data would just create confusion and noise in a plot like this. The data has been passed through a linear filter that has the effect of flattening the noise spectrum of the LIGO detectors. So the noise spectrum is measured, and we set up a whole bunch of little filters that adjust the amplitudes of the frequency components so that the noise spectrum is flat. And what that does to the signal is that it comes out looking like this. The reason we do this is because this has the effect of transforming the data into a coordinate system in which normal vector inner products can be used to measure the distances between things. So in particular, we can measure the distance in this waveform space between this data vector and this signal vector using a simple vector inner product. So overlaid on the data is a cyan curve. This is the 90% confidence envelope of the samples from an MCMC parameter estimation code. So you can see it's very tightly constrained. This model imposes the assumption that general relativity is correct. The darker blue one does not. This is simply a wavelet-based denoising of the data. It does not impose general relativity as an assumption. But it does assume that this signal is made of time frequency components typical of the scales that you see here. The little wiggles are not what general relativity predicts. This is the result of sending the signal through the same linear filter that has been applied to the data. So its frequency components have been screwed with. So we extract two pieces of information from this. We take the projection of the data onto this template, and that inner product is the signal-to-noise ratio, the matched filter signal-to-noise ratio. And as people have said, we also subtract the template from the data, and we compute a sum of square residuals to get an estimate of the goodness of fit. It's not quite that straightforward. You have to be careful picking which samples to use and so on, but more or less what we have is an inner product and then a square magnitude residual. And you can plot them together on axes like this. So on the horizontal axis, you have the matched filter signal-to-noise ratio. On the vertical axis, well, it's this sum of square residuals measure divided by SNR squared, just to sort of normalize out the trend with increasing SNR. the orange density is the distribution of the noise population that comes out of the Hanford detector on the left and the Livingston detector on the right. The red X is the location of the first Monday event, that's GW150914 in this parameter space. The blue plus is the location of the second Monday event, and I don't have the location of GW151226 plotted. But in the case of 150914, what you can see is it's off the edge of this orange. There's literally, in this coordinate system, there is literally no noise at its location. So we actually lack the ability to estimate its statistical significance. What was done was we modified the noise model. We took, we took the triggers, basically the data that results from this event itself, and said, let's just call that noise. We'll put it into the noise model and modify this probability density to include things from this event itself. And that's what you end up with, this little weird banana-shaped thing hanging off the distribution, caused by the candidates resulting from this feature in the data itself. So now, by construction, it has a little island of probability density that it's sitting on, its own. And so now you can stick a number on this and compute its false alarm probability. This is really should be interpreted as a bound on the false alarm probability. This is not a good noise model. We do not believe that this little banana thing models the noise correctly, but it gives us a number, and that is 1.4 times 10 to the minus 11. So it's an extremely statistically significant event. As I said, without this, it can't be computed. So this is the sort of plot that you've seen, and on the horizontal axis we have ranking statistics. So this is the SNR and chi-squared values digested down into a single number that measures the quality of the event. It allows you to rank things from most signal-like to least signal-like. And on the vertical axis is the number of events, and this is the event count binned by ranking statistics. So this is kind of important, and I think that these plots are not being properly described. Certainly in the press conference, on a number of occasions, people pointed to events on a plot like this and said, see how high it is above this curve, that's how significant it is. That is not correct, and I want to make sure that everyone understands this, because this plot actually does not convey the statistical significance of this event. You can't use the counts binned in these little ranking statistic bins to figure that out. And I'll give you a couple of reasons why. The first is, you might ask yourself, how have the bin sizes been chosen? For example, we have a room full of theoreticians. You should be used to just want to get an intuitive feel for something, dial the values up and down to their extremes and see what would happen. So in the limit of zero bin size, if you shrunk these bins down to zero size, each bin would have either one or zero events in it, if the event happens to fall in the little measure zero bin. So this plot would look like a little forest of ones and zeros normalized to this. So you just have this little grass plot. The other extreme, if you take the bins to infinite size, all events would be in one single bin, whose height is simply the total count of events. So what is this bin size? Well, what people have done is manually adjusted the bin size until they get a plot that they like. So what you're seeing is really the author of the plot's impression of what they would like you to see, not a conveyance of the statistical significance of the event. That's why these bars at the top are added. This is where the actual statistical significance is shown. What you'd have to do also, the other information that's missing from this plot, is the number of events to the right of the plot. What you're not seeing is the frequency with which, say, log lambda 90 events are produced. And if by chance there's an enormous mountain of events up here, in fact, seeing things here is not really too significant, because in fact the pipeline is producing an enormous number of very highly ranked events. So what you want to do is you need to do an integral of this plot from the right-hand side, from infinity all the way down, to see the total rate at which events greater than some value get produced. And of course, you would like not to introduce an artificial binning. And this is what that plot ends up looking like, which you can see in the O1 BBH paper that has also been published today. So here, now you see the noise model. This is the, there are no longer stair steps in it. It's a continuous function of the ranking statistic. And what it's showing is the number of events greater than or equal to this threshold that you would expect in a signal-free experiment. So if you set a threshold, for example, at a ranking statistic value of 20, then you might expect 1/100th of an event. If you set a threshold at 10, you might expect a few hundred of events in a signal-free experiment. The black is what we actually observe. So at 80-something, we see one event. At 30-something, now we have seen two events, and as you lower the threshold, we see a third, and so on, and then suddenly there's a big mountain of events as you lower the threshold even more. So what you can see on a plot like this is that the noise model very accurately predicts the behavior of the pipeline at low significance. So we have a very good handle on the behavior of the pipeline in a signal-free noise environment. And you can also get a sense of how large a departure these things are from this curve. We cut it off at 10 to the minus 4, just so you can see the structure up here. What you're seeing here is a signal population model. This comes from the assumption of signals being astrophysically distributed, so uniform in volume, uniform in time, with a mass distribution inferred from the candidates that have been observed. And the overall amplitude of this has been obtained through Bayesian inference process to infer the number of signals that are present in the data set. And you can see that the black curve does a good job of matching a noise plus signal population. GWB150914 continues to be an outlier. It is an unusually loud event at the end of O1, putting everything together. So it was a lucky first detection. It was unusually loud. We hope to see more high SNR events, but it was a lucky first detection. This second Monday event, it has this funny date code. You can see that it is actually consistent with this population. It kind of rounds out the picture. From those first 16 days, we did not have the Boxing Day event here. We had only this one and this one. So the presence of this candidate in the data set was actually quite significant because it is what led to the appearance of a consistent population of events. We were not seeing some lucky outlier or somebody playing a joke on us, but in fact, the data was consistent with an astrophysical population present in the detector's output.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's actually 98%. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So P signal given data is 98%. Yeah. For this, it's much higher, and for this, it's like 0.9999. There's like 11 nines. Yeah. Okay. So to interpret these observations, and this is what people have been talking about today, we need to understand what it is we've been seeing. We need to understand the physics of the source. If our assumptions of the physics of the source are incorrect, then our interpretation of what it is we've seen will not be correct. So how do we get a handle? Oops, how do we get a handle on this? We employ two different phenomenological models calibrated to numerical relativity simulations to infer the source's properties. And we look for evidence of departure from general relativity in an attempt to constrain general relativity itself a little bit. So starting with the Boxing Day event's properties. Here again, you see the data. Now, this is not whitened, as people have said. This data has been passed through a band pass filter with a few manually inserted notches to try to pick out the signal a little bit. It hasn't gone through a formal whitening process the way the previous plot has been. So, for example, I didn't point it out, but the other plot had a second y-axis, which was standard deviations from the mean, which is a label you can put on the data once it's been whitened. This filter has had an overall normalization applied to try to maintain strain units here, but of course it's a filtered version of the data. This is the signal-to-noise ratio time series. So if you take this template and you slide it along this data, what you see is this kind of grass of noise, 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 and then a spike, an SNR of a little over 10, and then back down. And at this point, when the template is aligned with data as it is shown here, this is how the SNR integral looks in the data. So it's accumulating up to 10, which is when aligned with this point. So this is not the integral of this function. That's important to take away. But it shows you where up here the signal-to-noise ratio is being accumulated. You can see a great deal of it is coming from the last few cycles. And here's the time frequency plots for this event. It's visible in Hanford. It's not visible in Livingston. You can kind of imagine that you might see something here. But of course, there's all sorts of little swoopy features all over the place. So it's really not visible here. But that night, this was the plot that convinced people to take this seriously. When we were seeing, we could see a visible chirp structure. This is why we stayed up so late that night. So inferring the masses of the two events, here are the posterior probability densities for the mass of the heavier of the two black holes and the lighter of the two black holes. By convention, M1 is always the heavier of the two. So that's why there's a cut here. This is the equal mass line, and by convention, we require the heavier mass to be mass 1. So there is no probability mass on the other side of the equal mass line. So the banana-shaped structure is always here. You can see the masses themselves individually are poorly constrained, but there's this combination of the masses called the chirp mass, which is very well constrained with this event, as always. again, these masses are the source frame masses. They differ from the Earth frame masses by about 10%. Now the spin, this is what's interesting. So this plot has the spin of mass 1 and mass 2. The radial component here on this plot is the magnitude of the spin, and the angle from the top of the plot is the angle between the spin vector and the orbital angular momentum vector. In this coordinate system, the prior probability density is uniform. So any structure that you see is there what the data has told you about the candidates. So you can see that the M2's spin is essentially uninformative. The data is uninformative when it comes to the lighter black hole's spin. But the heavier black hole spin almost certainly has a positive Z component. The component in the horizontal in the plane of the orbit is essentially unconstrained. But this object is definitely spinning, and it's definitely not maximally spinning. So this is new from the first detection. We still do not have any definitive evidence for whether the spin and the orbital angular momentum are aligned or not, and that would be a clue as to the origin of this system. If the spin and the orbit are aligned, then that suggests a pair of black holes that have been in orbit around one another for a very long time. An early formation for the system and a very long, slow evolution. Misalignment could suggest a recent formation, so some sort of dynamical capture in a dense environment where you have two otherwise unrelated objects that have been brought together. Their spins are not necessarily aligned with their orbital plane, and and they just start undergoing evolution together very quickly, forming a very quick merger. So again, here is the mass-weighted combination of the spins. The vertical component is definitely not zero, it's definitely positive. And the in-plane component is basically unconstrained. Okay, so what can we do to constrain general relativity? Well, people have talked a lot about that. What we've published is the following sort of approach. So as has been mentioned, we mostly lack the ability to directly connect observations to departures from general relativity. It's one of the sort of weaknesses of the field at the present time. So what we've done is adopted a mostly phenomenological approach. So as you probably know, numerical relativity simulations of black hole mergers are very costly computationally. So these large banks of template waveforms that we compare the data to are not produced by doing numerical relativity simulations for all the possible waveforms. What's done is a small number of numerical relativity simulations are performed, and then a phenomenological model is constructed with a bunch of parameters in it that can reproduce functions of time that look like compact object merger waveforms. And the parameters are adjusted so that they reproduce known numerical relativity waveforms, and then the assumption is that in between the points in parameter space where numerical relativity simulations have been performed, this phenomenological model will still produce an acceptable version of a compact object merger waveform. But the little parameters that parameterize these phenomenological models give you a handle. There are the values they get set to reproduce all of the numerical relativity waveforms, but you could imagine just messing them up a bit and producing non-GR gravitational wave signals. And so that's what we do. What we do is we look for evidence of departures for these parameters from their GR values. So for GW150914, the first detection, this is what the result looked like. So allowing these parameters to vary produced a model that has been called the GIMR, the generalized, or I don't know what the G stands for, IMR, phenomenological waveform. And it has all these mostly meaningless parameters. So this model is basically a sequence of power laws in the frequency domain that are stitched together with various slopes and amplitudes and complex phases and so on. And these parameters more or less are parameterizing this kind of piecewise polynomial function. And they're organized in left to right order from the low frequency part of the waveform to the high frequency part of the waveform. So this is the early in spiral, and this is the sort of ring down part of the waveform. The red, whatever they're called, I plots, give the posterior probability density for the, this is the departure of the parameter. So zero is the GR value, and this is the delta. The red is the posterior PDF on this parameter. If each parameter is allowed to vary individually, the cyan is if you allow all the parameters to vary together. So if you look at these red ones, so the little bars mark the 90% confidence interval. So 1 in 10 of them you expect to disagree just through random chance. But if it looks like more than 1 in 10 is stretched beyond the sort of GR value. So the red maybe gives you the impression that there's some tension here with general relativity. But if you allow all the parameters to vary together, then you find that, in fact, the data does not really constrain these parameters at all, except in the ring down, which we have, as people have shown, we get a nice clear view of the ring down. So they're properly constrained. okay, so here is the same plot. This is from the paper that has just been put on the archive, now with the cyan removed. So this is just the if you allow each parameter to vary individually version. And this is for 15, 12, 26. You can see it agrees better with general relativity, apparently. Now this is, again, if you only vary each parameter individually. The constraint from allowing them all to vary together is not shown. And then if you assume that both have been produced by the same laws of physics, and so you require the same parameterized model to produce both waveforms, then you get this constraint. And if you flip back and forth between 15 and 914 and the combined, you can see that with one additional observation, we're now really in pretty good agreement with general relativity. There's no longer any reason to suspect a tension here. Something else that's interesting, general relativity predicts the presence of two polarization states in the wave field. Gravitational wave antennas, including bar detectors and the laser interferometers, are generally only sensitive to one of the two polarizations. This is akin to an electromagnetic dipole antenna, which is only sensitive to one of the two polarizations of the electromagnetic field. So if you have a network of antennas, then each of which is sensitive to a different polarization, then you can measure the number of degrees of freedom in the wave field. You can see, is the wave field always linearly polarized? Is it circularly polarized? And so on. LIGO has only two antennas, and they have been constructed to be as aligned with one another as permitted by the curvature of the Earth. So LIGO is actually not able to constrain the number of polarization states. The LIGO data can always be made consistent with a theory of gravity that has a single polarization state. So it will be really important for Virgo and also CAGRA to join the network. Virgo will allow us to measure the second polarization component, and then CAGRA can nail both down or tell us if there's evidence of a third. So this will be really important. One of the reasons knowing the polarization is important is that it's degenerate with the distance to the source. So if you see the compact object merger down the Bohr site of the orbital axis, then what you see is circularly polarized radiation, but it's also more intense. If you see the system edge on, then what you see is linearly polarized radiation at a lower amplitude. So if you can tell if you are seeing circularly polarized or linearly polarized radiation, then you can determine the distance to the source more accurately and do some additional tests. So the binary black hole merger rate. So the second candidate, as I said, had a significant effect on this. In fact, it's almost identical to 1509-14. If you filter the data with a single template that matches one or the other, you recover both very well. So as far as the detection pipeline is concerned, the two are almost indistinguishable. You can disentangle the two parameters, but they're very, very similar systems. So as I said, its presence initially in the first 16 days established a sort of a coherent source population, which allowed us to say that in that first 16 days, we were seeing a signal rate of approximately 4.8 signals per experiment. So there were the two that we could point to, and there was statistical evidence of a few more that could not be disentangled from the noise candidates. In fact, the observation of 15-12-26 actually does not change this rate significantly. It narrows the uncertainty in it quite a lot, but the rate is basically the same. It's actually come down just a little bit because it has reinforced the appearance that 15-09-14 was a lucky outlier. But it's not a significant effect on the rate. So that is unchanged from before. and this is the plot I showed earlier, and again, you can see that 1509-14 is an outlier, and the presence of this one reinforces this interpretation. Okay, so prospects for future observation. Yeah. Oh, like in terms of mergers per, yeah. So this is the easiest thing to measure, signals per experiment. Now, turning that into cubic gigaparsecs mega years per experiment is more complicated. We have to measure the sensitivity of the search pipeline. So that's why you end up with a huge uncertainty in this range, right? Like, I can't remember the numbers. It's 100 to 400 mergers per cubic gigaparsec per. Yeah, it's a huge, yeah. And a lot of that comes from the difficulty in measuring basically the conversion factor from, try to figure out just what experiment we did.
If I just take that number and you say that was actually an outlier, you have to be, if you're the lower end of that.
Well, it's both bounds come in and it sort of, yeah, it's a little, it's shifted a little to the left, but it's basically the same range. Yeah, basically the same range, yeah. okay, so looking to the future, we can talk about the volume times time, so the space-time volume observed in the O1 science run, and if we project to the future, so we take the ratio of a future science run's volume times time to O1's VT, we get numbers like this. So for example, 1, this is O1, and here's 10 O1s. O2, so the science run that's going to start in September, is hoped to have a space-time volume somewhere in this range, between twice and seven times what O1 had. And then O3 is hopefully 10 to 30 or so, 25, 30 times O1s. So these curves are the probability that you have n detections greater than the blue curve is greater than 10 detections, greater than 35 detections, and greater than 70 detections given your VT. So if you have a VT of 2 O1s, then there is a 15% chance that you will have more than 10 detections. If you have a VT that is 7 times O1, then there's a 15% chance that you'll have more than 35 detections. So for O2, at the low end of the numbers, we're looking at maybe between, like, it's unlikely to have that we'll have less than 10 detections, and fairly certain that we'll have more than 10 detections. There's 85% plus probability that there'll be more than 10 detections. There's a slight chance we could have more than 35 detections in O2. By O3, you're looking at sort of 50% range of in the 30s to over 70 detections. So as people have pointed out, in the not too distant future, we'll be in a situation where we can start doing high number statistics kind of studies with these events. We won't be talking about single events, we'll be talking about statistics of catalogs of events. So this is something that I think we're really not ready for theoretically, so I hope people are working hard on preparing for this. Okay, so what I haven't talked about the binary black hole merger rates implications for the spectrum of stochastic gravitational waves. There's the burst search that identified the candidates. I haven't talked about it. I haven't really talked much about the instruments. Or the rest of O1, all that was presented today was the summary of the binary black hole searches. We have not presented the searches for binary neutron stars or for black holes over 100 solar masses. So those results are to come in the near future. And of course, O2 starts in a few months, so well, get ready. So thank you very much.
Okay, questions?
The mass-weighted spin chi effective, the published value for 15.0914 is very low.
Yeah.
Could be zero. Some people have claimed that this is in tension with binary black hole evolution models. What was the value of chi effective? I didn't catch it.
Yeah, for
the
this
second
one,
event.
Let me see if I can. So this is about a quarter.
A quarter.
Yeah.
So it's also low.
Yeah, it's not a maximally spinning black hole.
Okay, very evolution models. Past models tend to give chi effective of order one, actually.
Yeah, yeah, that's it's been suggested that they should be higher. Yeah, yeah. I think this is interesting. What can I say? Yeah, I think there's a. Oh, this battery's dead.
So how confident are you of the interpolation between the numerical simulations? In other words, if you found a significant deviation of one of the parameters you showed, is it a deviation from GR or just the fit to the sim? Yes, this.
Yeah. I'll show you this one because this was the final, this is the combined. So one of the questions is, is the model itself flawed? And so this is, I actually did not mention this on the way through. One of the challenges in analyzing the data is that you have to calibrate the LIGO interferometer. So ultimately what the readout is a photodiode that is counting photons. And you have to translate that into a displacement of the mirrors, a strain in this interferometer. And that conversion of photon counts to strain is this sort of calibration process. And it's challenging because the LIGO interferometer is the only device in the world that can measure displacements as small as it can. So there is no other device, no other displacement meter you can go and calibrate it with. A series of sort of bootstrapping using just faith in fundamental physics is used to establish the calibration of the interferometer. Two techniques that are used is there's a laser beam, an auxiliary beam that's bounced off the mirror and intensity modulated. And the momentum transfer from that beam to the mirror creates a sinusoidal force, which can be seen in the data. And if you understand the momentum transfer of the laser off that mirror, then you can use the observed fluctuations at the frequency that you're driving it at to establish the displacement relationship. Yeah.
I think it's like on systematic
analysis. Yeah, yeah. And so here's the thing. So what people have talking about now doing is saying, screw it, let's use GR to calibrate the interferometers. Let's assume that these waveform models are exactly correct and solve for the transfer function that gives us a correctly calibrated waveform, right? And as soon as you start doing that, then you can no longer start asking the question, is this waveform model correct? Because your data is always going to say your waveform model is correct. So there's a risk I don't know how to approach this, but people do need to, I think, make sure that they don't lose sight of the need to address systematics in these waveform models. And you know, if you start seeing perfect agreement between phenomenological waveform models and an O3 LIGO that is being calibrated to 70 detections, I think we're going to lose some of this. Yeah.
So you can look at constraints on this. You can look at constraints on these PPE parameters with different GR bases. So there's many different phenomenological models. There's the EOB model, the IMR phenom, A, B, C, D models. And the constraints don't really change beyond like 20 or 30% depending on which GR model you use. So the implication is that the systematics introduced by not knowing exactly what the GR template is are not really contaminating these constraints. If these constraints get significantly tighter, then you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, then there's the extra stuff stuck on. Like there's a little Lorentzian that's stitched onto the end. And yeah.
You just maybe one more comment on the same lines as Yassine's question. Of course, the way the phenomenological models are calibrated is to take some subset of a catalog of simulations and to try to tune those parameters and then check that the rest of the catalog matches your model to some threshold, which for LIGO right now has been the catalogs used in the spec group match to like 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 5 in the overlap of these waveforms. So, and that's maybe about as good as you can do, considering they have residual eccentricity and other issues that lead to 10 to the minus 5 maybe or so errors anyway. So that's obviously something that would have to be improved if these got really profoundly good. And you always have to check and worry that you don't understand the full parameter space of binary black hole mergers. But in general, people try to make sure that you can do this interpolation that Kip mentioned accurately just by sort of a random sampling of the space.
Okay, let's thank our speaker again.